You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. Across the table from me, it's Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Kate, just the two of us today.
It's lonely in this room.
So lonely. Neil is away watching baseball in Japan.
Is he really in Japan?
He is really in Japan.
Is he really watching baseball?
He's really watching baseball.
So he's the biggest baseball nerd that ever lived, whoever lived.
That wasn't clear before he went to Japan to watch baseball. I mean, I feel like this is only furthering the legend of Statman Neil Payne, that he would follow through on being the person we thought he
embodiment was. Embodiment of Statman nerd baseball man. Do you think he'll listen to this episode? Can we just totally lay into?
Do you want to expose your secret feelings towards Neil?
Let's talk about Neil, okay?
Yeah. I mean,
I actually love Neil.
As do I. No, Neil is in Japan. I think a travel agent booked the trip, including the Japanese baseball game, which was so perfect.
People are still using travel agents?
I had a long conversation with him about this.
He used a travel agent?
He's a big supporter of travel agents. Here is his reasoning.
Oh.
His reasoning is he works too much. True. I can vouch for it. He doesn't have the time to plan a great vacation. He could just like show up to Japan and figure out what happened once he was there.
Right.
He did it for his honeymoon with his wife, and it worked out really well. And so it's worth the extra couple hundred bucks to get a great vacation and not squander the week and a half that you're there, or be worried for the week and a half before you go about how you're going to have time to plan the great week and a half.
I do understand that, and plus you're keeping in business travel agents, but I think half of the excitement about a trip is like the Google searches about what you might do and the looking up of the airfare and like the building of anticipation that comes with planning your own trip. I wouldn't want to surrender that to someone else.
You invest in the trip by putting so much time into the planning of it. That's interesting. Well, we'll have to ask when he comes back whether it meant less to him.
Yeah. At a later date.
All right. On today's show, we are going all Olympics once again. First, 538 Editor-in-Chief Nate Silver, the man himself, we'll stop by to tell us why the medal table is broken if you don't have enough time to watch every single Olympic event. And I've been trying, but I just can't find the time. He has a solution, and it's one that makes the U.S. even greater than they already are. Make the U.S. great again.
I can always count on Nate.
On the Olympics table, exactly. Then Alice McCann will call us from Rio to try and explain what happened to the U.S. women's national team.
I got some theories, too.
Cowardice. That's your theory?
Yeah. Whenever you play a bunch of cowards, you lose.
I know.
That's my theory.
That's how I feel whenever I go toe-to-toe with cowards. So when they lost to Sweden in the quarterfinals of the Olympic tournament to their former coach, moreover, there's some real Shakespearean meat to that. And Allison will. And we'll talk about what that defeat means for the U.S. women's national team's future prospects. And then finally, Usain Bolt won his third straight Olympics gold medal in the 100-meter dash on Sunday. He'll go for two more golds over the next few days as he tries to complete a historic triple-triple. That's the 100, 200, 4x100 relay, 3 years in a row. Three Olympics in a row. We will chat about how you can compare athletes over time, given that people are saying Bolt is now perhaps the greatest track athlete of all time, and whether or not, as I heard on the broadcast, he's in fact the greatest athlete of all time.
Oh, I'm in on this one.
And then finally, Joe Sykes, our producer, is going to break up our Olympics fund to talk about what else? Soccer, football.
Every time he comes in here for the sig dig, he's always got a football sig dig. By football, I mean soccer.
Yeah, it's his British routine. You know what he wanted us to talk about this week? How Britain was doing better than expected in the medal table.
He's a cliche.
He's a jingoist. So Joe will come by. We'll make fun of him. It'll be great. But before we get started with the show, one little piece of business to take care of. That is a new podcast from the folks at ESPN. It is called Pin Kings, and it is about wrestling and crime, and they are billing it as sort of like the serial of sports. So it is, it's a podcast that has 16 episodes, and it chronicles the journeys of Alex DeCubis, not sure how you pronounce the name, Pin Kings will know, and Kevin Peterson. They were high school wrestling co-captains whose lives took totally opposite turns. by the double meaning of the title, you might get the sense that one took a turn towards crime. And indeed, one became the biggest trafficker of Colombian cocaine on the East Coast, while the other became a DEA agent responsible for hunting down his former teammate and best friend. It's got a little Serial, a little Breaking Bad. It's worth listening to. And new episodes are being released every weekday in August, and one is going to hit the Hot Takedown feed coming up this week. So take a look out for that. We're posting episode one, Off the Mat, Off the Grid, in the Hot Takedown feed tomorrow. And you can get all 16 Pin Kings episodes in the ESPN app under Featured Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, now with us, you may recognize him from another podcast from the 538 family. It's something about politics, maybe about elections. Nate Silver, star of the 538 Elections Podcast. Hello, Nate.
I'm a co-star, actually.
Yes, absolutely. So, Nate, recently on the site, you told us all about a problem that you were having. A problem in which you just didn't have time to watch every Olympic sport, and moreover, did not want to watch the Olympic sports that nobody cared about. And you thought that the medal table was needed to reflect that.
No, it's kind of ridiculous that they spend all this time playing field hockey, for example, or beach volleyball. I get deep into the, you know, MSNBC and CNBC weird things, right? I'm like never watching at the right time, but like at weird times, you know. But anyway, the point is that there's not a lot of correlation between how much time people spend watching sports and how many medals are awarded in those sports. So for track and field and swimming, it's fine. People love those sports. I love the sports too. But there's a medal awarded like every 10 minutes, right? But for others, it's way off. Soccer, actually, a lot of Americans don't tend to watch that much Olympic soccer, but people around the world do. It's the fourth most popular sport in the Olympics. Only two gold medals, one for men, one for women. You know, even though people spend a lot more time watching soccer than shooting, for example, which has 15 medals. So we designed a way to make the medals proportional to the sports people actually give a damn about.
I like this because I do become accustomed, the sports that I tune into, the Olympic sports I tune into, I become addicted to the burst of adrenaline that comes with understanding who's in a race or a competition and then being immediately awarded a winner. And then the spike in stakes and adrenaline that comes with that. And when that doesn't exist, I often find myself like, okay, this is a long haul type Olympic sport. I deal with that in the rest of the non-Olympic. I'm here for the quick fixes.
You don't want the tourneys.
No, I'm like, that's what the World Cup is for. That's what an NBA season is for.
I kind of agree about basketball and soccer. But, you know, some of these sports, like volleyball, for example, I'm not a big fan of the beach volleyball, but the gym volleyball, what do they call it, indoor volleyball?
I think you just call it volleyball, right?
Volleyball.
I think the one we separate is beach volleyball.
Yeah. Beach gets the modifier. Volleyball itself is classic.
Or handball, which is like the sport.
That's team handball.
My friend Ray and I invented when we were like eight and really bored and like just made up some rules at random.
Team
and now
handball
apparently
is the best.
Turns out the people in Hungary have been using those rules for a long time.
So are we we're trying to alienate a lot of athletes here and fans of sports. Is that our end goal?
Well, first of all, you know, if you have a 20-person team, how come you don't get 20 medals for winning the soccer gold medal, for example?
Each athlete does get a medal, we should be clear. It's not like they have to
cut
one into 20 pieces. But it's not the Stanley Cup. But
the medal
you want
count
on the medal table because this is the number of athletes who are required to win.
But, I mean, that's not to be clear, it's not my proposal.
Right.
I'm just saying that we should, again, make medals. We
make medals great again.
Make medals great again. Yeah.
So,
in the medal count.
Right.
Yeah.
So
America.
Importantly, you know, some people might look at this and say, you know what, soccer should have a relay the way that all these other, you know, sports do, because that's where a lot of the medals stack up, is that Michael Phelps will swim in, let's say, three events, and then also those three events relays versions for their team. And that's how there's so many medals in swimming.
I do think there should be ways to maybe break from the normal form of competition for the Olympics. You know, I don't know why NBC was televising Olympic golf, but they were the other day. Like, why not use a match play format or something that's a little bit funky?
You see that in cycling a little bit, where you have these points races as well as the road races that are outside, as well as all these other things I don't fully understand. We were watching some yesterday in which if you lap someone, I think it was called the Ominium. If you lap someone, you get 20 points. If you finish a sprint first, you get 5 points. And that felt like a novel form. Maybe it exists outside the Olympics too, but there are a lot of different entry points into a sprint.
Right, and now I want to know what the origin story of relays in track and field were? Like, was it born of the fact that people actually realized, like, occasionally the fastest way to get somebody somewhere might not be for one person to run, but four, let's see how it goes? Or was somebody at a meet like, let's make something more exciting and we want to see this new action happen?
And why isn't there like a track and field backstroke or something, right? Where people run then, backwards.
Then I would have a stronger case as Usain Bolt as the greatest ever athlete at the Olympics, because he would have...
Save it for the third
segment.
I'm with you, though. The fact
save
that
it.
He only does one thing. But anyway. So Nate, you looked at what the Olympic Committee said the number of hours were that people watched every sport, as well as the number of medals awarded, and you created something called a medal multiplier. So run us through what this medal multiplier means.
So it's just a number you need to make medals proportional to how much people give a crap.
So for example, track and field has a medal multiplier of one.
So it's perfect. You know, 47 medals in track and field. So it's the most popular sport, most medals. That works out fine. Swimming is a 0.9, basically equivalent. Gymnastics gets a little bit of a boost. You know, particularly those team competitions, there's a lot of effort put in and not that many medals awarded, no matter how great Simone Biles is. She probably can't compete in all that many events. So it gets a 2.0. Which helps the USA and China and countries like that. Soccer, though, gets a 12.9.
Wow.
So the value of the gold medal, and there's only one distributed, therefore.
Compared to viewership, right.
Yeah. I'm just average Joe out there listening, trying to interpret this.
And so basically team sports get a big multiplier for the most part. Basketball does as well. Team handball, I don't know.
Even team handball, okay. 2.6.
All right, that's good.
There are a lot of people
What's the
in
lowest?
Moldova.
The lowest multiplier, it seems to me, is
point two for taekwondo, sailing, and canoe kayak. And by the way, this is not like that imperialist. So, for example, badminton is quite popular worldwide. Table tennis is quite popular worldwide. So it's not just the American-centric sports.
Empirical but not imperialist. That's the 538 motto.
So when you say how many people watch, these are not the American television ratings.
This is not weighted by, you know, equestrian gets downweighted, for example. I know people are excited about horses dancing. How is that a sport?
That's this dressage, okay? So importantly, we should note, this makes sense to me. Someone looking into your own background and your own biases might say, Nate, America, the U.S. of A., does great in this new adjusted popularity medal table.
Well, so does China. So does Brazil, for example, which is good at team sports but doesn't have as many individual stars. They did well in gymnastics this time. You know, look, people get cute and kind of say, make up various excuses why the U.S. is not great again in the Olympics. And they're like, well, you know, medals per capita or per GDP or whatever else. My argument is that the U.S. is pretty great because the sports that countries are investing in, the sports that are the most competitive is where we have a larger advantage. You can also see, for example, the country that got downward adjusted the most, this is from 2012 so far, was Great Britain.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Which is a country in the Olympics and not a country. But like,
they're always into stuff nobody else cares about.
They're into weird stuff, but also if you're the home country, you get qualified into every sport, and that's a bigger deal than you would think, right? If we had no limits on how many teams could qualify, right? The U.S., frankly, you know, maybe we'd have the first and third, not this year, but the first and third best women's soccer teams in the world, or the first and second best men's basketball teams.
Well, and it's not just that. It's
and
also
like pole
within...
vaulting. I know we have like the best pole vaulters, and then like somebody who doesn't even qualify would probably compete.
And it's even
so
within this.
If USA is number one, USB.
And it's even within the sports, too. We saw in gymnastics and women's gymnastics that Gabby Douglas was cut off.
Ali Raisman, and
Hernandez was cut off of competing in the individual all around. I think only the top two from each country could make it, or something like that. Okay, so Nate, so far in the Olympics, have you run any of the numbers? Do you have a sense for whether the U.S. would still be on top? I would assume they would, just because they're so far ahead in the medal count.
When you say they, you mean we, right?
Yes,
they.
Sorry, how dare I?
They. This year I don't think. Well, so first of all, the big payoffs come when you win the big medals in team sports, and those competitions last the whole 2.5 weeks, and so they've not been awarded yet.
US
we heard our
soccer
chance
really...
a little bit with the women's soccer, but yeah, we're gonna win. Right. I mean, it's a pretty big advantage.
Look at that, a certified Nate Silver prediction right there. The U.S. will win no matter how you make up the medal table. All right, Nate. while we have you, what are you looking forward to in the Olympics? Left to go. Are you a canoeing guy? Are you a dressage guy? What's your
when is the archery started yet?
I think archery began. Yeah, I'm not sure if it's over yet. That,
so, I think we've pretty well established that Nate likes the stuff that's really popular, haven't we? Right,
well,
the events.
Yeah. What's your favorite obscure one?
I mean, curling, but that's wrong. Olympics. Yeah.
Olympics. Yeah.
I mean,
I'm a team handball guy. I think it's
a weird
ideal
sport. I mean, I like the classic. You know, one thing I get annoyed by. I don't mean to rag on NBC, a worthy competitor to ESPN, but some of the track and field events that don't feature the Americans, some of the longer races or the steeplechase or the long jump, they're just being shown in snippets, and that's a little bit disappointing to me. When we used to have kind of Carl Lewis and great decathletes, those events were also big deals. They weren't the sprints, but I wish there were a little bit more of those. So I'd be actually kind of more lopsided toward athletics, as they're officially called.
All right, Nate Silver. Listeners, you can hear Nate on our sister podcast, 538 Elections. You may already be listening to him there. Nate, thanks for coming by.
Thank you, guys.
All right, now let's keep the Olympic train rolling and go to Brazil to talk to our correspondent on the ground, Hot Takedown's correspondent on the ground, Allison McCann. Hello, Allison.
Hi, Chad. How's it going?
It's going well. Allison, how many different sports have you watched in person since we last spoke to you last week?
I'm doing really well. I think I've probably seen at least 15 different sports.
Wow. Cool.
It was the number's gone from 3 to 15, so it's been a busy week.
Yeah.
It is, yes. I dipped into track cycling yesterday, which is maybe my new favorite sport.
Yeah, were you there for the collision?
Yeah. It was wild.
And then you got back on the bike and finished and won, right? Or is that a different race?
One guy did, yeah, the Italian, but the collision took out three people, so others were...
Someone was hospitalized, yeah.
Wow. Allison, you also just watched the women's soccer match, which is what you're here to talk about. We're going to talk about the U.S., but first, let's get your reaction to Sweden beating Brazil on penalties.
I know. I'm so sad. I'm so bummed. Well, first of all, my bus never showed this morning. I was supposed to go, and I waited. They were every 20 minutes, the bus to Maracanã, waited for almost an hour, and then I was I give up. I'm going to miss the game. So I've been watching here in the media center, which has nice big TVs. But yes, Sweden defeated Brazil on penalty kicks, the third penalty kicks this tournament, which has been wild. And yeah, I'm really bummed. I was banking on Brazil making the final and winning and seeing them and Marta, bringing glory to this country. So I'm sad.
So Allison, was Sweden's style to just continue being as big of cowards as they could possibly be? What was your interpretation of Pia Sundhage's game plan? Is she continuing on with the kind of pack it in and taking advantage of the strength of her players?
Yeah, it was. I mean, I guess that strategy beat the U.S., so it was almost identical today. The possession in the U.S.-Sweden game, the prior game that we lost was the U.S. had about 63% and Sweden had 37. Today, Brazil was almost 70, Sweden again 30.
Wow.
The U.S. had 26 shots, 5 on goal. Sweden had 3 in that game. Brazil today had 32 shots, 11 on goal. Sweden had 6. So they are not playing the prettiest of soccer. It is proving very effective, however.
Okay, so I know you seemed sad about this result of today's match with Brazil being eliminated, but let's go back to the U.S. team and that outcome, because I think for just mainstream everyday fans, this was a shocking outcome. Now, on this podcast over the last year since the World Cup, we've talked, and we were even talking about it within the World Cup back in 2015, about how the U.S. has not exactly been playing at elite world domination levels, even within last year's World Cup. Before Megan Rapinoe and Lauren Holliday had yellow card accumulation, we were even on this podcast talking about all right, the U.S., what's going on here? Because their style of play doesn't really match with their talent. And now you fast forward to these Olympics and their elimination, if you've been following this team, isn't as shocking, I don't think, Allison, as it might be for somebody just parachuting in. What have you seen from that team actually on the ground and in the weeks leading up? Were you shocked?
Yeah, I think, like you said, the Olympics are so much different than the World Cup because you're going into the quarterfinals and you're already playing Sweden, one of the best teams, you know, in the world. So whereas, you know, back last year in the World Cup, you know, we were playing, I think, China in the quarterfinals and sort of lower ranked teams. So I guess it's shocking in just that we've never gone out in a non-medal game in the Olympics. We haven't not medaled. So that was, I think, just like you said, for casual fans, really difficult.
But Allison, the probability of it wasn't that shocking if you look at the forecast that you put together with our colleague Jay Boyce, right? It was only, what, 38% chance that U.S. women would win the Olympics?
Yeah, which isn't like super high, but it was much higher than anyone else. Whereas last year in the World Cup, the U.S. and Germany were almost, you know, tied for that first place slot, and this year the U.S. had quite a bit of a lead, which I think was fair because of obviously winning the World Cup the year prior and gaining in strength. You know, we had Mallory Pugh, we had sort of these new Lindsey Horan in the midfield, who I really liked, and those players didn't do as much as I was expecting them to this Olympics.
Yeah, but what's going on with the U.S. team? Because there were lots of questions after last World Cup that, like, Jill Ellis, yes, she was the winning coach for a World Cup team, but there were a lot of questions about her decision-making and her lineups and our style of play and how U.S. soccer is running this women's national team. Do you think that this cup, it has to be qualified as a disappointment, means that there's going to be any changes to some of these important factors, whether it's keeping Hope Solo in goal, kind of forcing a change in style to match more of the younger dynamic play? Like, will we see any significant changes coming out of this disappointment?
I don't think so, because I think, honestly, obviously that game was super disappointing to lose. The U.S. played pretty well. You know, I guess there can be an argument that we didn't have, you know, very good finishing, but we had, you know, more than five times as many attempts as Sweden did in that game. And I think Jill Ellis did take a bit of a gamble in this tournament, bringing, you know, Mallory Pugh. I would say my biggest criticism of her was the substitution in the game. She brought in Megan Rapinoe for only, I think it was about 20 minutes, and then brought her immediately right back out. And so that sort of, I think, was the one big question mark. People were saying that, you know, you brought this unfit, you know, recently injured player, and that was like the person that you wanted to change up that game. So I think her in-game strategy wasn't great, but heading into the Olympics, she did, you know, she brought Mallory Pugh, she brought sort of these younger players that we didn't see. You know, Pugh was on the scene last year, but we didn't see Crystal Dunn in the World Cup roster. So I think Jill Ellis was at least trying to be a little bit more, you know, creative in this team. And yeah, I guess it did kind of backfire, but I would be surprised to see, like, I don't think she's going to be fired or there's going to be like drastic cuts on the team or anything like that.
So Allison, can we get to the coward comment from Hope Solo? So after the loss, after the penalty shootout loss, in which, you know, I'm sure Solo was smarting about the loss in penalty shots more than most, given that she was the one who had five shots come at her. But it was Hope Solo said that Sweden played like cowards, basically, as Kate mentioned earlier, because they parked the bus and really played a defensive posture. And it seems to me, I remember we had a similar conversation when Greece won the Euros, however many years ago that mm-hmm. was, when they played a really defensive game and ended up winning the Euro Cup. And I think Portugal this year had, in the men's Euro Cup, had some similar whisperings about sort of not winning the right way and all that stuff. And it just seems to me like this is a debate that doesn't go away within soccer, that there is a right way, quote unquote, to play this game. And we've talked about this a little bit before, but is the coward comment sort of part of that whole debate around whether or not there's a right way to play soccer in the women's or the men's game?
Yeah, I think the coward comment, well, maybe the not exact right phrasing, but was fine and it was totally justified. It is a very cowardly yet effective way to play soccer. You can kind of, yeah, soccer is weird in that you can put 10 people behind the ball and sort of pack everyone into your defense, knowing you're playing a stronger opponent. Sweden has a, you know, a very solid defensive back line, and just kind of like take shots for 120 minutes and hope you get into penalties. And it's a really challenging way to break down too. You know, it's hard to, when there's so many people around the ball in soccer, it just like clogs everything up. Passing lanes are collapsed. And so, it's I guess it's not wrong. It's just from a spectator perspective, it's very unfun to watch. And from a player perspective, I think it's really frustrating too, because the things that you're used to, nice passing, Brazil sort of 1-2 touching, all of that gets closed down, and you kind of sort of just have to resort to the way that Sweden is playing, and you're like, okay, like, we're just going to lob long balls into the box where there's 12 people and hope it kind of gets scrambled around and goes in.
The content of what Hope Solo, if you look at her longer quote, the content of it makes sense in terms of articulating a frustration with a style of play. It's just simply her putting her own editorializing on it by saying that playing this type of strategy style equals cowardice, that I think is probably the flaw there in Hope Solo, which is stacking on top of numerous off-field incidents, whether it's DUI, team bus, or a domestic violence arrest that's like still open, right? Like, to all of like mainstream consumers of this U.S. team, it was like, we understand what you're saying, but like, this is a mistake to then articulate it one step further by making a judgment about Sweden. But I think the overall discussion about like whether it was Greece, and I think in 2008 possibly when that team won the Euros, mm-hmm. and then this Sweden team, if they do go on and win gold here, when you say that they like they've played this kind of like differentiated style, I think what happens in a fan's mind is that there's no longevity to it. Like there's no, it feels like not the best team didn't win. It was this team that sort of created a tweak and creatively was able to surprise people by this unorthodox style, and you don't think to yourself, oh, that's a like a dynasty in
but
the making.
As we've talked about many times in this show, maybe we need to change our understanding of what the best team is, that if
right.
you know, the best team is the team that wins, and you call it there.
Sure, and I think that Pia Sundhage is one of the best coaches in the world and is super smart, and like responded to Hope's comments and said, yes, I don't think she said yes. I think it's cowardly, but she was like, that was our strategy and we executed it and we won the game. And so I think there's also something to saying like, you know, really good teams can find a way to sort of break that down or get it. You know, Brazil had a few really great set piece opportunities that they didn't convert. So, you know, there's something to, yeah, the effectiveness and having a strategy and doing it well, that while it may not be nice, beautiful soccer that is working.
And I think soccer is one of the only sports where you can, we don't like as fans when a team is playing to not lose. Like, that's not what we want to see. It doesn't seem like it's dovetailing with like the agreement we've made in a sporting event. And soccer is one of the only sports where you can incorporate that type of style, and then you've got the end game of it being penalty kicks, which then takes it to a place where it doesn't matter if you don't attack at all. Whereas like you can't in basketball, you can certainly like slow the ball down, but you can't then end up in like a free throw shooting competition at mm-hmm. the end. So this is a perfect strategy in a sport like soccer where you can end up with that 50-50 gamble at the end of penalty kicks.
Right. Change the rules or teams aren't going to change the way they play,
right.
basically. So Allison, real quick before we let you go, Germany was already the favorite remaining in the tournament before Brazil lost to Sweden. Do you think that still holds, even though now we know that Sweden can, you know, back-to-back do this strategy that maybe can foil even Germany's attack?
I think so. At least in my book, Germany is still the favorite. They have some great attacking players, Anja Mittig and some others that might be able to penetrate Sweden's wall of players. But I'll know more, I guess, after the Germany-Canada other semifinal is going to happen now. So I'm curious to see how that shakes out.
Okay, great. And Allison, your time in Rio is growing short. I think come next Hot Takedown, you will be back in America. What are you most looking forward to catching before you go?
I'm going to head back to see some track cycling finals today, and I know absolutely
You're
nothing
hooked.
About track cycling, but it was wild, and the arena is just insane. You know, that thing, that track is so steep, like I can't even describe, like I don't think a person could like run up it on their own. So yeah, I'm gonna go see that today. I'm gonna catch some BMX cycling tomorrow.
I forgot BMX is in the Olympics.
Yeah, it is.
Extreme Olympics. Cool.
So yeah, I got a few more things on the docket, and then I'll we'll hopefully be at the women's soccer final on Friday before I head out.
Excellent. Cool. All right, Allison McCann, our correspondent in Rio. Thanks, Allison.
Thanks for having me.
Looking forward to having you back. Before we move on to the next segment, a word from our sponsor. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using your phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinancing in just a few minutes. Get a custom mortgage solution at your own pace, whenever and wherever you want. So if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/takedown. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender. It's licensed in all 50 states, and its NMLS, consumeraccess.org number, is 3030. That's its own kind of significant digit, I suppose. And one more time, if you're looking to buy or refinance a home, check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/takedown. Okay, now on to track and field, where I was on a couch in Chicago over the weekend watching with some friends.
Sounds very Olympic of you.
Very Olympic, let me tell you. That I have a great couch seated. I have an epic immortal one. And Usain Bolt, they typed that race for like at least an hour after the semifinal. Usain Bolt lines up in the blocks. Lines up in the blocks? Gets set in the blocks? Not sure what the official terminology is. To go for his third straight 100-meter dash gold medal. And then this happened.
Is Usain Bolt about to rewrite the record books again? Gatlin got a good enough start. Bolt was a bit slow to begin. He's got some work to do. Gatlin's in front. Bolt stretching out now. He's coming after him. He's immortal now. Usain's done it. Gatlin challenged for the silver medal. 9.80 all the way from Beijing to London and now to Rio. It is one of the greatest athletic achievements of all time, if not the very greatest.
Can I jump in?
Please.
I thought when the race was over, he said, he's an immortal male, but he doesn't. He says he's immortal now, right?
Because Australian little.
At first, I was like, he's an immortal male. So I was glad that I at least processed it a little further.
So, Kate, lots to unpack in that announcer's call as well as Bolt's accomplishments overall. I think before the race was done, there was a little one of those gauzy Olympic packages on NBC that Bob Costas sat down with Bolt in Jamaica, said, are you the most famous person in Jamaica? And then there's lots of talk of Bob Marley. Anyway, NBC said that based on how often world records get broken in the 100-meter dash, you'd have expected Bolt's 2008 world record, which still stands, of 9.58 seconds, to have happened in 2038. That it would have taken an extra 30 years based on the innovation. So between that world record being ahead of its time, between three straight gold medals, 100-meter dash, and I believe the 200 so far, he won 2008, 2012 as well, and May in 2016, is it reasonable to say that this guy's immortal, that he's done one of the most impressive athletic accomplishments of all time?
Yeah, I mean, I think within that NBC broadcast, they also made the point that no other Olympian in the 100 meters has even more than two medals, like that's it, and it's not two golds. Whereas Bolt,
so the longevity now comes into play,
right? So it's the longevity in a sport that usually is like a snapshot kind of sport. Like you are at the peak of physicality and everything that has to be coinciding in the human body to become the fastest man ever, and usually you can only hit that peak once. And now here's a guy who's hit it three times. And the discussion around Bolt at these Olympics, the same Olympics in which we've had the discussion about Michael Phelps, has he cemented his
immortal legacy. Immortality
as the greatest Olympian of all time? It also is a reflection of how we can be prisoners of the moment. Because, like, for example, on my radio show on Sundays, and this is obviously before Usain Bolt has really even been introduced at these games, we did a poll about who's the best Olympian athlete at these Olympics, and it was Michael Phelps, Simone Biles, Usain Bolt, or other. And Usain Bolt was fourth on that list. He was getting beat by other. And Michael Phelps
because
was a runaway with it.
Because
like we're prisoners of the moment, and we hadn't been introduced to him yet, and now all of a sudden people are reminded, and then you're also introduced to statistic greatness and also the number of athletes competing for the title that he's competing for, and you're reminded again of like what he's done is unprecedented.
So a couple things. One is, I think because of Bolt's physiology, because he starts races slower and seems to finish them faster, although I guess I read in somewhere today that none of the sprinters are getting faster as time goes on. Some are just slowing down less than others.
Right.
But the narrative is so perfect because it basically looks like a come-from-behind race for Bolt. Because he starts slow, there is this moment of real panic. Oh, wait, is this hyped guy not going to be able to pull through,
mm-hmm.
even though he's won 69 of 74 races in his career? But he finishes so much faster than everyone else that it feels like a perfectly distilled and encapsulated version of a sports narrative, which is, you know, the showy favorite who's cocky, at least, you know, some interpretations would say, before the race, gets in the blocks, starts from behind, and and all of a sudden all that talk was for nothing. And then you have the sort of equilibrium moment where it seems like, oh wait, he's catching up, can he pull it off, especially against Gatlin in his race over the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this triumphant come from behind narrative. He almost, because he starts so, he humbles himself in a way that I think makes it easier to root for someone so great.
Yeah, because you want, as a viewer, it wouldn't be fun to tune into that race unless you had allegiance to another country or another athlete, to want to witness history. And then in that moment, the protagonist of this story gets beat by even a few steps. You're like, that's not what I tuned in for.
Right.
And it's also not what I tuned in for to see Usain Bolt just like burst out of the blocks and be like in the middle there and then kind of win at the end. Maybe
right.
He could either totally dominate the whole race and then like do his look back where he's just like smiling, and that's great, or what he always seems to do, which is burst on at the end and allow us as humans to go through the range of emotions that come along with like an underdog victory, underdog only in that 10 seconds span.
Right. You could say the same thing about Katie Ledecky, whose greatness comes from how obliterated the field is when she's done. It's not that she wins mm-hmm. from pole to pole, but it's that she wins in a way that's historic every
right.
time.
And okay, so I'm going to play host here for a second and like transition us, right? Because like when we start discussing like greatest Olympian of all time, the only measure we seem to have are medals. And it so harkens back to our discussion that we have on Hot Takedown all the time is like, have we overvalued championships and titles? Because that's the yardstick for how great an athlete is, like how many NBA titles do you have? And so when it comes to a discussion of like the greatest Olympian of all time, everybody seems to just point to like, well, Michael Phelps has 23 golds and 28 overall medals. I believe those are the numbers. Therefore, it's a runaway victory for Michael Phelps, because that's our yardstick in our head, are like these gold medals. And yet, so when you look at Usain Bolt and he's won 3 golds and 3 back-to-back Olympics, so I think he has 8 overall.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be, so he's a third as good as Michael Phelps? Is like, is that the math that we're doing? Is because he's
a third
of medals?
Well, that's what Nate
was
talking about earlier,
yeah.
Right? The sports have inequality around the number of medals that they hand out. And as a result, I'm not sure you can look at it that way. But what was troubling to me about, and I think we mentioned this when Nate was on, what was troubling to me about the idea of Bolt as the perfect Olympian or the best Olympian of all time is he's certainly the best at his event. But he only does one thing. He'd be super good compared to the rest of rest of the world at lots of other things. But he can't. I mean, what we saw the South African 400 meter runner Wade van Niekerk do in the 400 was, in a way, to me, just as impressive as Bolt. It just so happened that there's a glamour around the 100 meter dash, and so it's the marquee event, and therefore, if you are dominant at the marquee event, that must make you the best track athlete, maybe the best Olympic athlete.
Well, he's not good at just one thing. He's good at two things. I mean, he's good at the 200 meter too. And I get what you're saying about like the 400, the 400 meter, like feeling, I guess, because it's like a longer event and there's not like, it's not like a heavyweight punching back type of competition, but it feels like we skew heavy on your medal count as embodying it and not even stopping to think how someone could accumulate the numerous medals. Like Usain Bolt does not have the opportunity besides relays, 100, 200. I mean, to stretch from 100 to 400 on a track and field would be, I'm assuming, kind of like stretching from the 50-meter sprint in the pool almost to like
the 1500.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, like that's the change in physiology and dominance that you would need. That those two don't translate.
Right, and that's what and that's what maybe where I'm getting a little turned around in swimming. Like, should we say that because Phelps can do a sprint and a mid endurance race, that is
really
a
it's about
skill
the stroke,
that,
right? Really, it's about the stroke. The differentiation.
You're saying
it shouldn't be
distance that we should evaluate someone's diversity of talent on. It should be about stroke.
Well, I think the question becomes, because I've never been a swimmer before, is Michael Phelps has mastered numerous strokes, and then within the Olympics, there's now the opportunity for medals is fourfold because now we've got these four strokes that you can master, and it's not like Usain Bolt can run backward for a medal in the Olympics, because we don't have different strides that get medals.
Right.
Then the question becomes, in swimming, how hard is it to master two strokes, three strokes, four strokes? Is it, as you grow up, of course you're learning these strokes, and now the Olympics provides you with an opportunity to quadruple your medal count versus being a runner?
Well, we don't see that many swimmers do all four strokes,
right,
other than in an individual medley. Mm-hmm. And so I think that probably answers it for us. At that level, it's very difficult to be that good at all four one-on-one and only doing that stroke. And I think there's something to that. So let's talk about how to, especially as we come out of these Olympics, how to translate Olympic accomplishment to athletic accomplishment overall. I think when I was listening to the NBC broadcast, I may be totally misremembering this. We weren't able to find it online based on NBC rights of what they put up. But that they said that Bolt is maybe one of the greatest athletes of all time now. And it gets back to this question of what it is that he's showing dominance at. And you could say the right. same thing for Katie Ledecky. You could say the same thing for all sorts of people in all sorts of different sports, including team sports in the U.S. around Sidney Crosby or around Mike Trout, whatever. Are we ever going to get to the place where we can really compare one athlete to another cross sport? It just seems like a losing cause.
No, it is a losing cause. I mean, this won't surprise Hot Takedown listeners, but when I'm processing this question in my head, like who is the greatest athlete, greatest female athlete, because you need to qualify that, excuse me, in our society. I'm like, whose athleticism would translate the easiest? And so when I think
to other sports,
to other athletic endeavors, like, do I think Katie Ledecky is fantastic athlete? Yes. Could she have been good at something else? Yes. Does swimming lend itself for me to believe that she could swoop in and play in the WNBA and play in these skill-based sports? I have
dressage.
No idea. Let alone kayaking. One has no idea. What I do know is, like, when I try and pinpoint which athletes' skills seem transferable to a number of things, I always go with skill-based sports because you are hitting on so many different factors. Like Usain Bolt, maybe he could be a great wide receiver in the NFL. Maybe he would be a great power forward, like a la Kevin Garnett. But you're not getting to see any sort of like hand-eye coordination, which maybe he has. But we see that in skill-based sports. And then we also see the kind of like explosion in running. So from like the eye test, you feel like our NFL players, our NBA players, certainly in some levels, soccer players, are hitting so many more of the boxes that we deem as athletes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think about that a lot, too, when I watch... Do you watch the CrossFit games whenever it sort of makes
no,
its way on the TV?
No, I have serious feelings about CrossFit.
Ooh, we should do that another podcast. But, you know, here are people at the height of this very specialized thing,
mm-hmm.
and they're winning, and they're doing things that look like what athletes do. They're bench pressing, and they're...
Right.
pulling ropes down a lane and all sorts of other stuff. And yet, this is where their athletic talent has manifested.
Right.
And so it's really hard for me to understand, well, if they were actually that good as athletes, wouldn't they have found their way into another avenue of
right.
more accepted athletic accomplishment?
We actually just watching a basketball or a football player's like off-season workout? When are we going to take all of those the athletes and then like play the game part? No, but I mean, CrossFit athletes are amazing, but I see your point there. It does look like we're actually like, okay, this is cool. They're doing all these things, but like, what is it leading to?
Right. And I would argue the same thing could be said to the 100-meter dash, although, you know, it is, their bodies look like the paragon of what
right.
body should look like and all that stuff. There's lots baked into it. All right. So Bolt, greatest track athlete of all time.
Let's qualify it even more at this Olympics.
At this Olympics.
Because we've got Carl Lewis, we've got Bob Beamon, we've got Jackie Joyner Kersee, we have FloJo. I mean, there's so many others. And then we'd have to start comparing eras. We need Neil for that, is the bottom
that's
line.
That's true. And I still come down to, and we need to figure out how
and
much
And I
diversity
named Americans there, by the way. Just named all Americans.
Our bias as an American podcast is really on display this time. All right, let's do a significant digit and then bring this show home so Kate can go on vacation.
Mm-hmm.
Joe, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
Thanks, Chad.
Joe Sykes, our producer. Joe, what have you brought for us?
Well, the Olympics have sort of covered up the beginning of the English Premier League season, which started last week. So I brought a sig dig about the amount of money English teams have spent on transfers this season, and the transfer window hasn't even closed yet. And that number is £794 million, which at a pretty poor exchange rate because of Brexit and things like that, is around $1 billion. That's 2 weeks before the end of the transfer window, which is almost breaking the record for the amount of money English teams have spent in the history of the Premier League. So and they've broken the record every year over the last 4 years. So it's sort of demonstrative of the fact that the English have a lot of money, even though they're not really sure what to do with it.
So, Joe, if you had to rank the three most exciting transfers that have happened in the EPL, what would they be?
Well,
quickly.
I think that the biggest one everyone's talking about is Paul Pogba, who was bought by Manchester United for $116 million, which is a record-breaking transfer, huge amount of money for a player that may not be worth quite that much. And it's also, there's sort of a lot of talk about this transfer because it really shows that teams are now willing to spend whatever they can to bring players in. And at a time, you know, when Leicester City won the league, having spent very little, it seems pretty short-sighted to me that that these big English teams are still kind of just spending money.
But you said they don't know what to do with it, right?
They have so much, and this is all they can do.
But it's not ending in success. You know, they haven't won a European Cup for 5 years. They haven't won the Champions League for 5 years. I mean, they're being taken over by their rivals who spend half the amount they do. It'll be interesting to see what happens this season. I think it's a symptom of some of the things that are wrong with the Premier League.
And the other two?
So, N'Golo Kante went to Chelsea,
I think,
for around $50 million. And he came from Leicester last year and is one of those players that really took them to Not one of the racist
Good.
Ones. One of the French ones Good. Who took them to the Premier League title. So that's an exciting transfer.
You don't even need the third one.
No,
wow. Okay. Kate, so nice. You could have put him on the spot.
You need a margarita, don't you?
Exactly.
All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Joe, thanks for bringing the sig dig.
Thanks, Chad.
Kate Fagan, have a great time on vacation.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer, we've already talked to him. We've already mentioned his name. You want me to say your name again, Joe?
Yes, please.
All right. Joe Sykes, the great Brit. Our podcast Alaskan in Alaska this week, Jody Avergan, otherwise known as our podcast overlord. We got production assistance this week from Tony Chow, Jorge Estrada, and Jonathan Yales. Thanks to all three of you. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We'd love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app, on iTunes, of course, as well. iTunes.com/538. Your reviews, your ratings, they are welcome. They help us quite a bit. And while you're reviewing and rating our show, be sure to subscribe to other ESPN podcasts, 538 Elections and What's the Point. And then that podcast I mentioned at the top of the show, Pin Kings, is there for the subscribing. You'll also get a little sneak peek in the Hot Takedown feed this week. All right, I think that is all I have to say aside from that our theme song is by Mystery Mansion, and that I am Chadwick Matlin, and I will talk to you next time.